people, they don't really have a faith, actually. So they just inherit the faith from their parents.
That's a problem. So that's why we, when it comes to even to our ulama, our maraja, when you pick up their book, the first mas'ala, the first issue they will say, they say there is no taqleed in fundamentals. There is no following, no imitation in fundamentals. That's something that you have to do, figure out yourself. Obviously, you do need a bit of help from here and there, you know, to learn more about
Allah. That's why, like we say, Ashhadu la ilaha illallah, I bear the witness.
Exactly. So the shahada itself begins with denial of Allah, and then is submitting to Allah. But after you've done the search, so you say, La ilaha, there is no God. You do, you search, then you submit. So, yep, there's a definitely a God, and say, Illallah. Then you affirm that belief. So you, there is a bit of requirement in Islam for me to go look and study, not just to take it blindly. So yes, when it comes to other religion, we are required to at least, you know, have a general idea of what they are on about. So you can at least protect yourself when you are put to the questioning by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, why Islam, why not Judaism, for example.
And Brother Sayyid Mohsin, we know for a fact that all the religions claim to be the righteous ones. So when this claim arises, someone's Christian, he's claiming to be on the right path. Muslims claiming on the same thing. So over here, do you think that the need arises that we need to learn about different religions, or everyone should learn about different religions?
Well, obviously Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created us and he has given us the power of intellect, being intellectual, obviously. And in the Quran also we see that Allah in many cases have said, أَفَلَا تَعْقِلُونَ أَفَلَا تَتَفَكَّرُونَ, don't you understand, don't you ponder. And as the brother has also mentioned, that when Prophet used to call the polytheists, they used to say that we are following our forefathers or the father's religion. And everyone, obviously, you know, the faith believe that everyone have, they think that this is right. Because maybe because they haven't read about the other things, or maybe they have sound proofs for that. So as far as it is concerned, obviously, there are people who say, like the Christians, they say they are the right ones. Muslims say they are the right ones. But the point is this decision is made on the basis of the research that they have done or not? Obviously, when someone says that he's on the right side and he's the one who's the guided ones, then obviously they have to bring proofs. From the Islamic point of view, we have many verses in the Quran that even the Christians, they used to say, like the Prophet Abraham is Christian. The Jews used to say he's from the Jews. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said neither he was a Christian nor Jew. He was a Muslim Hanif, and he was the upright person who used to worship one God only, and he was the rightly guided ones. So obviously this claim is there. Everyone has the equal right to claim. But the point is that whether are they actually on the right path or not, that's what, you know, after spending some time studying the religions, that's what we, that's when we know about this. And therefore, we have seen, like, there are many people who are the converts, obviously, from all sides. When they convert, the main reason of converting is
studying
that
the religion.
Yes, they study the religion, they find the facts that the religion or the ideology which they were following was not right, or there were some issues in that, and then obviously in Islam they could find the best answers of the questions. That's why they were converted.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Dear listeners, welcome back to Reality, and we are talking about how necessary is it to study about different religions. And Brother Mohsin and Brother Abdullah are here to share their ideas with us. Sayyid, I would like to ask you, Sayyid Mohsin pointed us towards something, that while studying religions, one need to study their own religion first. So in the modern society today, people have the ideology that some people say that children should have the right to choose their own religion. Like once they're adult, or once they're in their teenage, so they should have the right to choose their own religion, not necessarily to be on their father's faith. So over here, so this point clearly mentions, when you have the right to choose your own faith, you have to look into different religions.
Well, you see that ideology's got a it's right in a way and it's misused in a way. So we did say that you yourself and you have to give others the right to think and search for themselves and to find out the truth. Now, obviously, if you want to go to battle, you're not going to go without a shield and an armor and a sword. You know, you defend yourself before going to the field. When you get into other religions, I do encourage my kids to look up other religions, look up other faiths, and look up, for example, atheism and debates and stuff. But first, I have to give them the tools and the means for them to enter that field. So it doesn't matter what you, where you are, whether you're a Muslim or a Christian or a Jew or even an atheist. First, become professional at what you believe in, and then have the mindset to go search, and also have the mindset that you said that to have the free choice to change whenever you like.
Yeah, sometimes, what I believe in is when you study different religions, you get more stronger in your faith, like you're more firm and steadfast.
So it doesn't matter how firm you are in your faith, you have to leave a gap in your brain that you could be wrong. And that is subject to change as well. So because this is what happens with people. People, like, they get so much into their faith, they become blind followers. Like Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. He says in a famous hadith, he says, "Nahnu abna'u dalil, namilu haythuma yamil." We are the sons of evidence. We go wherever it goes. So if you come to me, for example, say to me, "You're a Shia," I say, "Yes." He says, "I could prove to you that Shiaism and the system of wilay is wrong." I'm saying, you know what? I'm more open. If you can prove me wrong and you have strong evidence to support your argument and I cannot defend myself, then I submit with my hands up. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I left the door open in myself that I am willing to change if I see the evidence. But if I'm just blindly, for example, I've debated so many people from different faiths, from different religions, from different sects. When you, they're not even open to the idea that they could be wrong. Say the Quran, even the Quran says, "Qul hatu burhanakum in kuntum sadiqin." Say, bring your evidence. I have nothing against you, and there's nothing, you know, in my faith that I benefit in that if I hold on so blindly to it, I'm going to get back. Right. So my faith says to me, look, you have faith of logic, faith of belief. If you can prove it to other people, good and well. If other people can prove you wrong, also good and well. So I have that. So I tell my kids, look, you have the right to choose, but not right now. Right? Let me teach you your faith.
Right.
Let me give you the weapons that you require. See if you can even accept it, if it goes through your system. If it does, then once you find yourself strong enough, then by all means, go. You have the freedom. But not like he's still like 7, 8, 9, 10. I'm like, now you have the freedom to choose your own faith. For example, in schools today, at least where I live, by class 3, they give the kids a choice to be whatever they want to be when it comes to gender. You can be male, female, you can switch your gender, and you can choose if you want to be with opposite gender as well. So I say you're free to be heterosexual or homosexual. So they give that choice. I'm saying, well, it's not, they're not ready yet. You know what I mean? You're giving them something they don't know how to play with.
So like, it's like, you know, people are manipulating children since a very young age.
So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is giving me intellect first and foremost to think and to, you know, use my brain. And then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala sent me messengers and prophets to guide me. He sent me books. And he sent me ayat. His ayat is in everything. His signs in everything.
Yeah.
So it's very hard for a person to be actually misguided. But if you want to shut down and you just don't want to accept anything and you want to go on the wrong path, then that's your choice.
So that's all the time we have for today. And thank you so much, dear listeners, for staying with us. And thank you so much, brothers, for joining us on the show. We leave you in the calm protection of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Until the next program, fi amanullah.
Ya Allah, ya Rabb al-alamin, ya Rahman, ya Rahim, ya Rabbi, let the ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
ya Rabb al-alamin, ya Rahman, ya Rahim, ya Let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
For the fourth time, the Israeli High Court has rejected an appeal made to release Kaid al-Fasfus, a Palestinian prisoner whom his health condition is seriously deteriorating due to his open-ended hunger strike that he started 125 days ago. Al-Fasfus is protesting his imprisonment under Israel's administrative detention without charge or trial. The Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, who made the appeal, says Al-Fasfus could be minutes away from sudden death, especially after doctors at the Berzelii Medical Center, where he's being hospitalized, said diagnosis showed he developed blood clots.
It's obvious that Israeli authorities want to adopt a new approach in dealing with the hunger strikes against administrative detention. They are exerting force at the utmost. Even if Al-Fasfus or other hunger-striking prisoners die, they don't care. Maybe they think this way they will be unfolding this file. We are continuing our efforts and we really hope Al-Fasfus won't die because the repercussions will be out of control inside the jails and outside it.
In addition to Kaid al-Fasfus, four other prisoners have been refusing to eat, also to protest the illegal Israeli policy of administrative detention. They are all demanding the occupying regime to either release them or prosecute them. Weekly protests continue to take place in solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners. Palestinians, including prisoners' families and relatives, have protested outside the building of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Ramallah.
Despite repeated warnings about the hunger strikers' deteriorating health conditions, Israel has always been defiant in dealing with their legal demands to make sure that no more prisoners follow the same path in the future.
The Israeli occupation does not know the meaning of humanity. Literally, those prisoners are dying. They must immediately be released. Their detention is illegal in the first place.
Over the years, Israel has placed thousands of Palestinians in administrative detention for prolonged periods of time without charge or trial, claiming they were arrested based on secret reports, which are inaccessible to prisoners themselves and their lawyers. Today, Israel holds over 4,600 Palestinian prisoners in its jails, with some 500 of them under the illegal administrative detention.
Prisoners' advocacy groups say the only request of Kaid al-Fasfus and other Palestinian hunger-striking prisoners is their freedom and an end to their arbitrary administrative detention. After 125 days of an open-ended hunger strike against Israel's illegal policy, Al-Fasfus' family says he would be victorious either through his long-awaited release or martyrdom. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Political factions in the Gaza Strip, along with the Joint Committee for Refugees, gathered in front of the UNRWA office in the Gaza Strip to reject the framework agreement signed between the United States and the agency regarding the restoration of U.S. funding for the UNRWA. The demonstration comes in conjunction with the International Conference for UNRWA, where several donor countries are scheduled to convene in Brussels under the chairmanship of Jordan and Sweden to discuss resuming the financial support to the UN agency and the Palestinian Authority.
We are holding this press conference based on our Palestinian people's demands all over the world. At the same time, the International Conference for UNRWA is being held in Brussels. UNRWA has been suffering from a critical impasse, and the victims of the shortage of aid are the poor Palestinian refugees. We are all united in expressing that we won't give up our right of return, and we have been calling for this right for 73 years. The international community is now in front of the real test whether to be committed to its conventions or not.
The framework for cooperation between the UNRWA and the U.S. for 2021-2022 calls for restoring U.S. funding to the UN agency after it was cut off for several years under former U.S. President Donald Trump. It includes that the U.S. will not make any contributions to UNRWA except on the condition that UNRWA ensures that no part of the U.S. contribution is used to assist any refugee receiving military training as a member of the Palestinian Liberation Organizations.
We are calling the donor countries to support the issue of Palestinian refugees that was founded basically by U.S. UNRWA has been the only witness for all the violations of Palestinians' rights, and the international community should maintain a long-term and sustainable fund to support Palestinian refugees until they gain their freedom. This is a systematic conspiracy to demolish the issue of Palestinian refugees.
UNRWA provides services, especially in health and education, for more than 5.5 million Palestinian refugees. Palestinians say that UNRWA must remain committed to its duties until their right of return is guaranteed. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
The Joint Conference of Syrian and Russian Committees formed last year on Syrian refugees' return was held in Damascus. Syria's Minister of Local Administration said amnesty decrees and investment laws issued by Syria proves the government's genuine desire for refugees to come back. Officials said hundreds of thousands of refugees returned in the past years.
We formed two committees from Russia and Syria for implementing steps for refugees' return. Over 2 million displaced Syrians returned so far. Nearly 1 million of them came from foreign countries. There are 13 border crossings fully ready to receive refugees. Return of displaced resulted in dismantling 26 temporary shelters this year.
Syrian Foreign Ministry officials asserted that the government continues to repair the infrastructure and restore basic services to areas liberated by the Syrian government from terror, noting to some obstacles in the face of refugees, such as U.S. and Turkish occupation of Syrian soil, support to terrorist groups, and looting natural resources.
The Syrian government continues to take all measures for Syrians' return. Our efforts are faced by some conspiring countries' attempts to take advantage of the refugees' issue politically and exercise systematic misleading campaign that the situation is unstable, as well as lies that refugees are in danger if they return.
Russian President's special envoy told Press TV that the West started to realize they should shift their policy towards Syrians' repatriation.
Western countries were doing everything possible, and there was huge information and campaign against what has been done here, you know, and they were trying just to convince everybody that the conditions are not ready for the Syrian refugees to return. It comes to this, to the understanding of the Western countries, that they have to start to be more active themselves now. I think that's a good start. It takes, they need time, of course, because they cannot just change completely their policy.
11 agreements and one contract have been prepared to be signed between Syria and Russia in the fields of education, medicine, culture, science, and industry. The gradual restoration of relations between Syria and the Arab world, as well as the enhancement of economic ties with the country's neighbors, constitute a spark of hope for all Syrian refugees that their homeland started its journey of recovery from war, a fact that represents a solid encouragement for their return. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Wailing and crying, seeking the dead body of their beloved son, the relatives of Mudassir Gul, a doctor by profession, was killed on Monday, along with other civilians and two fighters, during a gun battle in Srinagar.
Authorities say he was involved with fighter and killed in crossfire. We know he was an innocent. Now that he is dead, at least return his dead body. The police have denied us his last rites.
The military operation took place on Monday evening in Srinagar, the main city of Muslim-majority Kashmir. According to police reports, the fighters had holed up in a building in the Haidarpura area and were eliminated by the government forces. The Inspector General of Kashmir Police, while talking to the media, said,
"The building owner was killed in a crossfire, while the fourth person was an overground worker, OGW, who was provided his rented space to Haider, foreign fighter, for using the same as militant hideout."
The building owner's daughter, however, accuses the government forces of using his father as a human shield.
Security forces took my father inside the building, not once but thrice. On the third turn, he did not return, and they say he was killed in crossfire. Now that they have killed my innocent father, they must return his dead body.
The police chief said, fearing law and order problems, the dead bodies were not handed over to the families for last rites.
It is not sure whether a militant bullet or the bullets fired by forces hit him. It would be clear after investigations whose bullet hit him.
Following the COVID-19 pandemic protocol, the authorities in Indian-controlled Kashmir have denied the last rites to the families of fighters killed during the military operations in Kashmir since 2020. Dozens of fighters have been buried at far-off locations, guarded and inaccessible to families. More recently, Kashmir's tallest pro-freedom leader, Sayed Ali Gilani's family, was also denied his last rites, something for which New Delhi was highly criticized.
Although having a decent burial is a fundamental right, here in Kashmir, it is seen as a breeding ground for anti-India sentiments and irregularities. Human rights defenders say denying families a proper funeral for their loved ones is a gross violation of human rights and a reason for unending pain for their kin. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Iran's envoy for Afghanistan, Hassan Kazemi Qomi, has arrived in Kabul for talks on mutual and regional issues. This is the first time that a high-ranking Iranian delegation is visiting Afghanistan since the takeover of the country by the Taliban in August. In an address to reporters upon his arrival in Kabul airport, the Iranian envoy said he would meet senior Taliban officials, adding that security and economic issues would top the agenda. He stressed that two neighboring countries need to expand their ties in all areas.
Afghanistan has been destroyed by invaders over the past decades. Now it's time to rebuild the country. We will help our Afghan brothers rebuild their country. A secure Afghanistan can contribute to regional stability. Afghanistan and Iran should have safe borders and expand their economic ties amid U.S. sanctions. We also need to cooperate in the fight against terrorism, as our enemies are conducting proxy wars after their repeated defeats in the region.
On the other hand, the Taliban have voiced their interest in the expansion of ties with Iran. They vow to continue their talks with the aim of increasing mutual cooperation.
Iran's move to send its special envoy means that the country is seeking to establish normal relations with us and increase the level of cooperation between the two sides. We have many things in common, particularly when it comes to border security and economic exchanges, so we have to continue our talks.
Tehran has stressed the necessity to establish an inclusive government in Afghanistan, representing all sections of Afghan society. Iran has repeatedly condemned any form of terrorism in Afghanistan and expressed its deep concerns over the fate of Afghan civilians, particularly following the recent terrorist attacks which left hundreds of Shia Afghans dead or wounded. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Israel has always touted its intelligence agency as invulnerable, but a spate of recent hacking attacks against the regime has undermined the narrative. A hacking group which calls itself Moses' Staff has released a video saying it has successfully carried out a massive cyber attack on Israel and broken into the servers of its major companies. The group says it is now in possession of comprehensive data which include information on the location and properties of the regime's sensitive and vital systems across the occupied Palestinian territories. The data also includes airborne mapping surveys with 5-centimeter accuracy and three-dimensional images of Israeli military sites. Moses' Staff is the third group of its kind that has exclusively hacked Israeli organizations and released confidential information of high-ranking military officials in cyberspace in recent months. Such cyber attacks have exposed the weakness of Israel's spying apparatus. But such incidents are just the tip of the iceberg. In September, six Palestinian inmates escaped from one of Israel's highest security jails, which was described by Palestinian resistance groups as a major intelligence failure. Following Israel's 11-day war on Gaza in May, the regime's intelligence and spying fiasco also made headlines. This was due to severe blows the regime received after Palestinians fired thousands of rockets into Israel. At that time, Palestinian media said the Israeli spying services could not predict Hamas and Islamic Jihad movement's tactics to beat the regime's most wanted Iron Dome system. Israeli media also called for a purge of the regime's military leaders for their role in the failed war on Gaza. Such failures come amid internal divisions inside Mossad. Recently, three senior Mossad officials stepped down over what was cited as organizational changes by the agency's new chief, David Barnier. However, Israeli media have described their resignations as an earthquake. Such a description has highlighted major setbacks Mossad has suffered not only in field operations but also in cyberspace. The blows that Israel has received have further shattered the image of its invulnerability.
A weekend terror incident in Liverpool, UK. One man killed, one injured, and four aged between 20 and 29 arrested under the controversial counter-terrorism law. The mood among some, one of shock and disbelief.
Honestly, shock. You know, I couldn't believe it. I've never been around anything like this in my life. I moved up here just for uni, so to have something happen like this, you know, right next to my accommodation is very scary.
Police say the passenger, 32-year-old Iman Al-Suwaylmin, carried a homemade explosive device into the taxi. The driver, David Perry, locked the suspect in the car to prevent a worse situation, escaped with minor injuries. The timing has had everyone thinking, just 2 minutes before Remembrance Sunday, when the entire country remembers Britons killed in wars. In Monday, the government raised the terror threat level from substantial to severe, warning residents to be vigilant.
The police have now confirmed that this is being treated as a terrorist attack, and while the investigation continues at pace, you will understand that I can't comment on the details of the case or its motivation, but it is a stark reminder of the need for us all to remain utterly vigilant.
There are still three police cordons in the city, one here at the Women's Hospital, the site of the explosion, and the two major streets elsewhere. Police are still investigating to establish the circumstances of what happened. Police are still searching two addresses for more clues into the motivation behind the incident. Saeed Fariza, Liverpool.
The violence in Myanmar was not enough for us, says the desperate woman upon our arrival. She says we are calling God in every possible way, but looks like our prayers are not being heard. She has many complaints, yet she can talk about the basic ones.
There is a huge list of problems that we are facing, but the major issue is every one of us has not received free COVID vaccination, and many had to spend their own money to get those. Another major hurdle is the lack of toilets for us and shortage of water supply. With regards to food, God sends many good people to feed us almost every day.
After fleeing war-ravaged Myanmar and what the UN described as ethnic cleansing, they are now trying to rebuild their shattered lives in different parts of India. But in India, they are sometimes called termites, sometimes illegal immigrants. Apparently, they are also accused of illegal activities. But these claims were not reflected in the recently released National Crime Records Bureau analysis.
Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which means the world is one family, sounds like an encouraging phrase. But looking at the living conditions of these refugees leads one to ask question whether the world has abandoned its responsibility towards them.
Rohingya refugees are struggling to survive in the world's largest democracy with enormous quantities of effort. Over the last few years, the community is in utter distress, sometimes detention in midnight raids, sometimes their camps being mysteriously burnt down. Regardless of the refugee crisis across the world, this particular community continues to be unseen victims of violence.
Since our camp was razed down by fire, we have relocated to this place, and it's a very difficult situation in terms of living in crumbling space. We are having shortage of water supplies. A tanker arrives and it finishes within an hour. Another major issue is snakes on this land and the lack of toilets for women.
Official estimates suggest more than 40,000 Rohingya Muslims have sought refuge in India after a brutal crackdown against their community in Myanmar. Many refugees say they felt safe in India since they arrived, but over the last few years, a vicious campaign against their expulsion is haunting the community.
A
In an interview released by Al-Qaeda's media, the leader of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Khalid Batarfi, admitted that the terrorists have been fighting forces of Yemen's Ansarullah movement on 11 fronts. Batarfi said the role in fighting the Houthi fighters is clear and no one can deny it. This raises a fresh speculation about the cooperation between the Saudi-led forces and the Al-Qaeda terrorists, previously reported by media, including the 2016 battle for Taiz.
Al-Qaeda leaders' confession of their participation in the battles against the Yemeni army confirms our earlier remarks that there is a strategy taken by the Saudi-led coalition using terrorists to support its mercenaries, and this confession may be through which the Al-Qaeda leader is trying to prove their presence and that they have a role in a battle that has been going on for years. We will continue to liberate all Yemeni lands from terrorist organizations, whether in Marib or elsewhere.
Experts say the U.S. has been using and supporting terrorist groups in Yemen since the beginning of the Saudi-led war, just as it has supported the Saudi war on Yemen. They say the Yemeni army has proven this by seizing caches of weapons bearing USAID logos in Al-Qaeda arms depots.
The U.S. is the main supporter of Al-Qaeda, Daesh, and all terrorist organizations, and it seeks to control the countries in which the terrorists are present. When it comes to Yemen, Al-Qaeda failed in this, and the Yemeni army managed to expel the terrorists from their main stronghold in Al-Baida Governorate. The Yemeni army found tons of U.S.-made weapons in Al-Qaeda's warehouses in Al-Baida, and this is another proof that the United States is the main supporter of terrorist organizations.
Earlier this year, Yemen's Interior Ministry also said Al-Qaeda terrorists are fighting alongside Saudi-backed forces in Yemen's Marib province, where the Yemeni army is pressing ahead with a liberation offensive, which Riyadh denied.
The statement by the Al-Qaeda leader shines a new light on how the Saudi-led war has helped prop up terrorist groups in Yemen with the help of the U.S. Yemenis, however, believe that their army will eventually liberate the entire territory of their country from terrorist groups and occupiers. Abdul Latif Al-Washal, Sana'a.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, depending on Allah. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of depending on Allah Almighty. We know that Allah is our creator and we always need to be in a status where we depend on people. And the best person on whom we can depend is the personality or the entity of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. In one of the narrations, Imam Ali has said that the Tawheed, which is monotheism, it's in its true meaning, it means that you do not depend on anyone except Allah. Tawheed, where we say La ilaha illallah, being the Muslim, the very first statement which we say, or even to become a Muslim, the very first statement which we say is La ilaha illallah, there is no God except Allah. This means that you're accepting the monotheism. And this monotheism itself, it should show itself in our daily life. This wordings, La ilaha illallah, that there is no God except Allah. There is no nurturer except Allah. This thing should show itself in our daily life. And if this is showing, or if people can see that we only depend on Allah Almighty and no one else, then obviously we will be in its true meanings a Muslim. Because when we talk about the lifestyle, our lifestyle should be in a way that when we say La ilaha illallah, there is no God except Allah, then we only and only depend on the God and no one else, inshallah.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of depending on Allah, and we narrated a hadith or the tradition from Imam Ali alayhi salam. Now, when we say La ilaha illallah, which means there is no God except Allah, it means that we should not depend on anyone but only and only Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, who is the creator. And obviously, we can see in our daily life that we do say with our mouth, or we do speak or say these phrases, which is there is no God except Allah. But practically, we should think that whether we think that there is no God except Allah, maybe, you know, when we have difficulties in our life, maybe if I need some money, or I need to get some money, I need some money for my daily life or any needs that I have, what do we do generally? We need to talk to ourselves. We need to ask ourselves, what do we do actually? Do we really depend on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? And what does this depending means? That's also important, because, you know, sometimes people think that depending on Allah means to just, pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and do nothing. No, depending means that you do all your efforts and then you leave the results on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. For example, I work hard, I do whatever I can do in its halal way, not the haram. Please make sure that we mention the condition of halal, that through the halal means I do all my efforts, I work hard, and at the end I pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, oh Allah, give barakah, blessing to what I have done, and increase my wealth, my sustenance. This is what depending on Allah means, that you do your job and later you leave everything on the shoulders of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because the results are in the hands of Allah, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
the limelight.
Rather than contemplating sanctions, the EU is actually on the cusp of bolstering its relations with the Israeli regime. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Tamara Nasser, journalist. This article is published under the heading, "Is the EU really shocked about the killing of a Palestinian boy?" Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. A Palestinian child was killed by the Zionist regime forces recently. Mohammad Amjad Dadas had gone to the village of Deir al-Hatab near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, where the Israeli regime forces were attacking Palestinian youth with tear gas canisters and stun grenades. Palestinians were protesting the encroachment of the Jewish colony of Ilun Mor on land that was violently seized from the village. Mohammad 15 was with other boys from the New Askar refugee camp on the outskirts of Nablus, according to the human rights group Defense for Children International Palestine. The boy walked closer to the troops approximately 30 minutes after he arrived. An Israeli sniper shot him in the abdomen when he was 50 meters away. Mohammed was transferred to Rafidiyah Hospital in Nablus in a private car while bleeding profusely. He was pronounced dead an hour after he arrived. Muhammad's 10th grade classmates laid a shrine on his desk as they mourned for him. The European Union's representatives in the West Bank city of Ramallah issued a statement expressing shock over the killing of Dadas, describing it as the disproportionate use of lethal force. The EU did not say what level of lethal force it would consider proportionate, nor did the EU diplomats call for any sanctions to be imposed on the Zionist regime. Rather than contemplating sanctions, the EU is actually on the cusp of bolstering its relations with the Israeli regime. Talks on the Zionist regime's participation in EU's new program on scientific research have concluded, and it is likely that an accord will be signed before the end of this year. Known as Horizon Europe, that program has a total budget of around $110 billion between now and 2017. While EU diplomats in Ramallah may claim to be shocked, there is nothing out of ordinary about Mohammed's killing. So far this year, 15 Palestinian children have been killed by the Zionist regime in the West Bank, including East Al-Quds. And more than 60 children were killed in Gaza when the Zionist regime bombarded it for 11 consecutive days during May. Meanwhile, new details have emerged regarding the Israeli regime's killing of a boy in August. Imad Khaled Hashash, 15, and his brother Mohammed, 19, were awoken by the Israeli regime forces raiding Balata refugee camp in Nablus during the early hours of 24 August. The two brothers went up to the roof of their house to see what was happening as the Israeli regime forces were invading the camp and firing at Palestinians there. The Israeli regime army claimed that there was a violent disturbance of the peace. The military alleged that someone on the roof held a large object in his hand and attempted to throw it below. An Israeli regime troop was prompted to open fire as a result, the military claimed. But that's a complete lie. An investigation by the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem found. The group said there was no disturbance of the peace at the time. Imad Hashash was standing on the roof of his home with his brother filming the troops as they were leaving the camp. The killing was witnessed by Ahmad's brother Muhammad and by a relative standing on a building opposite. The witnesses corroborated each other's testimonies. Muhammad told Betslem, "I told Ahmad to get back, but he wanted to see what was happening and was filming it on his phone. I pulled him back." Ahmad went closer to the edge of again to see what was going on, and then I heard a shot and Ahmad fell face down on the floor. The brother's relative, 25-year-old Ali Hashash, was standing on the roof of his home watching what was happening in the neighborhood when Ahmad was killed. Ali told Betslem, "I noticed one of the troops looking up and aiming his weapon. I signaled to Ahmad that he should get back, that the troops were below. The street is well lit and we could see each other," he added. "Ahmad went back a bit and so did I, so the troops wouldn't see me. Then Ahmad went forward again and looked down, and I heard a gunshot followed by screams coming from his house." Muhammad and Ali described how the Israeli regime forces then fired tear gas canisters near their home. Ahmad's killing has left his family in a state of grief. Muhammad said, "I can't understand why my brother is killed. I looked at him and it was like a nightmare. We used to sleep on a mattress on the floor next to each other every night. If we hadn't heard the damn noises outside, Ahmad would be in school with his friends today." Ahmad's father, Khaled Hashash, recounted how his son had joked with him earlier that night about wanting to get married that day. Khaled recalled, "He tickled me under my armpit and I started laughing. Ahmad loved to joke around, but I didn't know that it would be last time he would joke with me. I wish I had known. He was an innocent, smiley, cheerful little boy who lit up our home and the whole neighborhood in joy. They killed him without any warning, for no reason at all."
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
I told Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. A few years ago I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. When we're talking about the social system in Islam and we're talking about social justice and the issue of how we are able to live a life of harmony, of peace, of coexistence, especially with people who we might not agree with, people who might follow a different ideology, a different religion, or maybe even people who have the same ideology, have the same religion, but might have a lesser understanding of how Islam is to be implemented in their personal lives. And of course, we need to have some kind of skill where we are able to adopt them in a good way, to not only be productive members of the society that we live in, but also set good examples as well. And something that Islam, we believe, is very clear about is condemning tyranny and oppression. And we can see that in the many cases of our imma alayhim as-salam, and also in the many cases of our esteemed ulama, there's always been that emphasis on never putting your hand in the hand of a zalim, never putting your hand in the hand of an oppressor. Now this oppressor might be someone ruling a government, might be someone ruling a business, a factory, or might be someone ruling a house. You know, zulm comes in many, many different ways and fashions. And I think something that I would like to work on here is when it does come to the issue of social awareness, although we need to look at it from the political side and standing against the oppressors of the world, which I think is extremely important, and I'll share some information about that from what Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli has to say. But I need to always remind myself and remind everyone around us that there's always going to be that level of zulm that we need to look at from a different angle. And that's what we need to work on as well. Zulmun nafs, where we wrong ourselves. Zulmullah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Zulmun nas. And these things could happen on a very personal level.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
You know, you could be very, very fair and just at work, but when it comes to your household, you are worse than Fir'aun. You are a zalim bima'na al-kalima, in the fullest meaning of it. You are an oppressor at home. You're smiling outside, at home you're always angry and grumpy. It could probably also be the opposite, you know, you're always smiling at home and you're always angry and grumpy on the outside. You're very fair and just at home, but you're oppressive and you're a tyrant when it comes to your business or your work or your school or your government or wherever it is that you, whatever it is that you're involved in. I think it's important for us to look at it in this particular way, because we do have many household Fir'auns around us, you know, who really are oppressing the weak in their house. You know, they are oppressing their spouse, oppressing their children and wronging them. And oppression and wronging is done in many ways. It's not only in physical abuse, domestic violence. It's probably in emotional abuse, verbal abuse. emotional neglect. You know, all these things are a part of volum as well, you know. And I think that's something that we need to look into and remember when we are talking about volum and oppression. Now, the important thing that we understand as Muslims, as far as a social level is concerned, is the rule of thumb that we have is always be against the zalim. Always stand against the zalim. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he says, أَلَا تَرَوْنَا أَنَّ الْحَقَّ لَا يُعْمَلُ بِهِ وَأَنَّ الْبَاطِلَ لَا يُتَنَاهَا عَنْهِ. Do you not see in the way that the Khilafah is going during the time of Bani Umayyah, do you not see that the Haqq is not being implemented and that the Batil is not being reprehensed? لِيَرْغَبَ الْمُؤْمِنِ فِي لِقَاءِ اللَّهِ مُحِقًّا. It's better off for a mu'min to meet Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It's better off for us to die. What's the point in us living if الحق لا يعمل به والباطل لا يتناهى عن. Which is exactly why, you know, when it comes to the responsibility that we have, it's always important for us to start this from a young age, when we are more innocent, when we're more vulnerable, when we have that flaming kind of vibrant attitude towards life. We're positive about things, you know. We're not gullible. We understand what's happening, you know, and we want to work on that. We will continue on with this topic in our next episode. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's screams.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane. And you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there. Be there.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.